For the next half hour, please join us for Know Your Media with Drs. Malika Ok and Betsy Bruner.
Welcome to the February edition of Know Your Media. I'm Betsy Bruner.
And I'm Malika Ok.
On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the influence of social media on the rise and fall of democracy.
Democracy under threat. That has been a common theme since 2016, after President Trump swept to power in the United States, and right-wing populist parties in Europe have achieved ballot box victories never expected or seen since after World War II. Books that have come out in the last couple of years, and let's remember, books are still media, all have worrisome titles such as Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency by Larry Diamond. How Democracies Die by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Seablatt. The Road to Unfreedom by Timothy Snyder, who's also the author of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, and How to Lose a Country, The 7 Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship by E.C. Temelkuren. There's certainly a lot of democratic angst out there.
But why is democracy under threat? I thought it was the premier system.
So there was this hope after the Cold War ended in the early 1990s that democracy and the liberal world order had won and that authoritarianism and communist systems had been defeated. But there is a new fear that this actually is not the case. And we see a rise of anti-globalist movements that all question the liberal world order and emphasize stronger nationalist tendencies. So a lot of these parties emphasize the need for a strong leader who alone can deliver people from their struggles. And an emphasis really on this idea of ethno-nationality, where the nation is defined based on bloodline. One interesting point here is that today these populist parties emphasize more the European or Western nation or the Western identity rather than just emphasizing Germans versus French versus Swedish. So instead, what you see is like we need to defend Western identity against threats from the outside. And most often, especially in Europe, that threat is considered coming from Northern African labor migrants or Middle Eastern refugees, specifically from Syria. And oftentimes these populist leaders actually use feminism and LGBT rights as a way to delineate them from us by saying that if we let those people in, we will see hard-fought victories of the women's movement or the LGBT movement being dismantled. This idea in Germany of the rapefugee, like the refugee who rapes German women, has been very prominent. The irony, though, is here that these right-wing traditional parties really oppose more progressive gender view and emphasize women's main role as mothers and wives and have a very patriarchal ideology. So overall, what you see is really a rejection of the global and liberal world order and a tendency to emphasize isolationist tendencies.
So I think this is pretty interesting to see. What you're describing sounds a lot like the authoritarianization of democracy or watching democracies adopt more authoritarian practices, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. And this is not to say that Europe is under threat of becoming more authoritarian, but I think there is a question whether democracy can deliver still and about the trust and confidence in democratic institutions specifically, where those right-wing populist parties really present an alternative to this globalized world order. So often in Europe, they are, for example, Eurosceptic and reject the European Union idea of this more supranational solution to world problems and are going back to national roots.
Okay. And I also think it's interesting to see this shift, especially given what we thought was going to be the more global spread of democracy that people were excited about during, for example, the Arab Spring in the early 2010s. And this is one place where social media actually comes in. So when social media was really blossoming and spreading across the world, some scholars like Clay Shirky really hailed it as being inherently democratizing. So basically, since everybody has access to social media, and since people can then become their own individual media outlets and they can share information, then we will see democracy spread. It also was used in protests like Occupy Wall Street, right? And in the United States, we were really excited about that because we saw this rise in protest and the use of social media to organize protests.
But I think there's also another side of social media. And you've been in China for the last semester. That's why you were not here on Know Your Media. And I know you're working on a new research piece that really talks about social media as a way to actually reinforce authoritarianism or at least increase the effectiveness of authoritarianism that actually might lead to the opposite result. So social media not as this great liberating force that allows people to rebel, but a tool for authoritarian regimes to maintain their hold on power. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, my research on it definitely comes from being in China and witnessing the pace of Chinese society today. So it's quite a bit faster than the pace of society, even in the United States. And this is something that social media has really brought about. So, for example, when I went to the grocery store in China and I tried to pay for my groceries, no one uses cash anymore. It's all electronic pay, which takes a half a second. So if I stop and give them cash, everybody looks at me weird like I'm writing a check in the grocery store because it takes so long for it to happen. So the speed of society is really quite different. And media has frequently changed the speed of society. So the telegram sped up communication and allowed people to communicate instantly. So did radio and then television. So one of the things is that social media now has changed people's, you know, in many countries across the globe, the speed of their society. And democracy is an inherently slow process that requires debate and deliberation. And so it does not match the pace of the rest of society.
And I think this is I was lucky enough to be able to visit you in China. And I think seeing it, I've never been to China before, I should say, but you have this idea of like Chinese chaos and so many people everywhere in the city and maybe a little bit dirty. But you didn't see anything like this in Beijing. And in fact, the technology and the use of smartphones and social media apps was so much more advanced than I've ever seen in any other part of the world, where like still my highlight of the visit is paying for a water bottle out of a vending machine with my phone. And it was such an easy, uncomplicated issue. And it's not just a supermarket, right? We went to little small vendors, street vendors, and they all have their QR code that you simply scan and then you have the money. And there seems to be a better responsiveness to concerns, I think you also mentioned in your research, that social media allows the Chinese government to have.
Yeah, so this, for example, with the coronavirus outbreak, the Chinese government has started different social media accounts so people can write in and offer suggestions and observations. Each city has a social media account where citizens can write in with complaints or suggestions, and they're supposed to be returned within 24 hours, which is actually quite fast, especially given cities like Beijing have over 23 million people in them. So, you know, their pace of society is just eclipsed ours in the United States. And they just rolled out 5G in December, and that's before the U.S., right? And they're investing a lot in AI, and they're investing in all of these technologies. And so they have this fast pace. And an authoritarian regime is able to, not all of them, right, but the Chinese version of authoritarianism is able to respond to the needs of society in a really fast and sweeping way, in a way that democracy cannot.
And I think this ties back to this idea about this common myth that China and Russia eventually, the people will rebel, and as China gets especially wealthier, and people will rise to power and overthrow the regime and democracy will be established. And from what I have seen, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, is that it is a very capitalist system. There was everything you could think of you could have, from Western brands to like made in China, little local shops, things. It was very convenient. Everything was clean. Everything was efficient. And considering how few people actually are engaged in an actual political process, I think if you're just going about your business, you want to have a family, you want to make some money, there's really no need to rebel because the system works for you. Of course, if you're a minority or prosecuted because of your political views, you will have a very different view on this. But I think the bright masses are not unhappy with their regime in a certain extent. I think social media helps with that.
Yeah, and the Chinese government is actually actively promoting their version of authoritarianism to the rest of the world. And we are watching certain trends, especially in places like the United States, trend towards authoritarian practices, right? So Obama used executive orders in ways that we hadn't seen before. Trump also has used authoritarian measures. He declared a national emergency in order to circumvent Congress and fund the border wall. He also moved political announcements to social media so that he didn't have to deal with the press anymore. He banned certain reporters from attending briefings. He appointed an acting attorney general to replace Jeff Sessions, even though he was unconfirmed by the Senate. So we see him taking a lot of actions that are actually have authoritarian characteristics to them that are helping to speed up the slowness that's required for democracy.
And I think this is a very complicated yet important issue to look at social media from every dimension. And to do so, we actually have invited Dr. Lorna Atkinson from the University of New Mexico to join us here on our Know Your Media episode. She's a professor and Regents Lecturer in the Political Science Department at the University of New Mexico. She has conducted extensive research on elections, campaigns, election administration, public opinion, political behavior, and the media. She is the director for the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, Democracy, and author of numerous articles about electoral participation and voting. She will be visiting the Pocatello campus as a speaker for the 2020 Frank Church Symposium on February 20th and 21st of this year. Welcome, Lorna.
Hello. I'm so glad to be here.
Lorna, the first question that we're going to ask you is, in a best case and worst case scenario, how do you think that social media is changing our perception of democracy, and specifically in regard to free and fair elections?
Well, I think the complicating thing about social media and the internet and all that it provides to people is that it's very fragmented. And I think that's very important. So we've really moved from, if we look back in time, from a very centralized system where we all saw the same news and, you know, therefore thought the same thing, to a very fragmented system of information. And, you know, that's a very big issue, I think, for understanding sort of democracy. If you just, you know, since the 2016 election, I have made a commitment to watch both Fox and CNN. And, you know, they actually are completely different news stations. They talk about different things. They prioritize different policies and people. And, you know, if there's a big event, then, you know, of course, they're focused on that big event. But you can even just go to their webpage and see that, you know, what are their top stories, and their top stories can be completely different. So fragmented media means that people are really experiencing different worlds. You know, their understanding of what's going on in the world is very different. And we don't recognize what the other's worldview is, right? We're not tolerant. We don't have intellectual humility towards the other view because it's our own view is so reinforced by the fragmentation and what we choose to hear. Because, you know, psychologically, we like to hear things that agree with us. And so that, you know, moves us to listening and paying attention to particular things, reinforcing our belief that the other side, that everyone else is just a mess. So we have no intellectual humility to understand or consider or even be willing to think about the other side's position. And that's true for both the left and the right.
So I have a follow-up question there, because I do also like to listen to a variety of different media sources, and I've noticed that they tell totally different narratives. So they're so different, you wouldn't recognize one narrative next to the other as being about similar topics. So have you noticed the same trend?
I mean, they definitely take completely different perspectives on, you know, similar issues, right? I mean, just the way they approach them, you know, what they think are the most important things, right? And these have to do with their viewers and, you know, their own ideological perspective. And those perspectives have been increased in this fragmented world, right? And that's I don't know what we can do about that. We have a problem. We have a problem with sort of, we have these information companies and there's no rules. There's no, you know, we're not considering that we're not sort of morally ready for the world that we've created.
Can you think of an example that has stuck in your mind about those, like the same event, but different narratives?
Well, how about something like James Comey, right? There's someone who has, you know, this is a real switch to me, right? So James Comey should be someone that the left should not embrace. My whole life, I've never seen the left embrace the FBI and sort of that level of law enforcement. I mean, there's just so much bad history there, so much bad blood. But yet, wow, they just embraced James Comey, right? They just, meanwhile, Fox News, so this is like a reversal of Rose. Meanwhile, right, Fox News, of course, is the law and order, right? Sort of the conservative community, which is usually all about law and order. You know, what is James Comey doing? What are his motives, right? Criticizing sort of our you know, intellectual, intellectual law enforcement offices, right? You know, really criticizing them. So these are really different views and a complete role reversal, right? I mean, very 1984, frankly.
Yeah, and the polarization, I think it's important to point out that the polarization that's occurring in the media benefits the media corporations a great deal financially because it allows them to sell more media. But it's horrible for democracy because if we don't talk to one another, then we can't be discussing these ideas, right? And then making decisions as a collective.
We're not willing, and we're not willing to talk to each other because we think the other side is just bankrupt. And this, you know, this is showing up in polls. And, you know, there's definitely, and this idea of authoritarianism is on the left and the right. And I think that we can see that, for example, in the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, right, who's particularly popular with young people. I mean, what is he talking about? He's talking about a revolution. But I was in Iowa and got to observe him at a concert with Vampire Weekend, and Michael Moore was there, and Michael Moore actually made allusions to Bernie Sanders as being like Jesus.
Wow.
Right. And yeah. Sort of, he talked about the loaf and the wine and that he was going to be able to, you know, take little and make many. And I was like, whoa, you know, and they're, you know, they seemed very concerned, very paranoid, of course, about the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party was booed at the event. So there was a lot of dystopia, perhaps, going on there.
And so what do you think is the appeal to authoritarianism for especially young adults today?
Well, I mean, I think always, you know, in particular, young people, of course, are more interested in change and revolution. And I mean, you know, the excitement, I guess, that centers around that. And I think these are just different approaches to solving sort of this underlying feeling for young people and other people that government is not responsive to them, that you know, that there's this class of people out there that are bureaucrats and politicians and intellectuals, and that these individuals, right, are not connected to the public, that they've created their own hierarchy, right, that is independent and that is driving America, and that they're not tapped into that. And I think that's true for young people, and I think that's true for a lot of old people as well. I mean, I think that's a fundamental, that's the non-responsive of what is it? Well, there's this intellectual, political, bureaucratic class that is in control of everything, and where do people find a way in?
So how does social media then reinforce those tendencies? And I'm also thinking about in comparison to the European system, because in the US, we have a presidential system with a majority vote where you need the candidate who wins the most vote gets the seat in Congress or gets the presidency, and all the other people who voted for someone else.
We have the Electoral College. So
yeah, okay. The Electoral College. Yeah, it's getting a little bit more complicated. Yeah. But there is like a winner-takes-all system, right? It's almost a zero-sum game, whereas in and Europe, you do have a proportional distribution of the vote where if your party wins 40% of the vote, you get 40% of the seats. So do you think that social media has the potential to be more divisive in one system over the other?
I think in both systems. I think we're seeing similar things in Western societies all across the world. And even in places like Latin America, where they've been moving towards democracy, you see on surveys that, you know, people are not that happy with what they're getting, right? That they haven't, people tend to be happy with what they are when they are working, when they are productive, when they have opportunity. And, you know, that's independent in some ways of the regime that they're under. I mean, obviously, if it's a Saddam Hussein regime and you're killing people in the streets, that wouldn't meet that definition. But there are authoritarian countries where people have opportunity.
So is there a way for social media to actually still combat that trend towards these separated societies who do not talk to each other? Or is everything lost now?
Or to put it another way, like, should we be, for example, regulating social media? Should we be applying the kinds of laws that we applied to television to social media in order to break up or decrease the level of polarization that's occurring?
Well, at the very least, companies, it seems to me, should be responsible for their content in some way. And just the way they were regulated initially, they weren't regulated at all like that. They're not responsible for anything anyone does. So, you know, if someone puts, you know, their mass shooting on Facebook Live, right, Facebook has no responsibility to that. And I think that there, you know, we need to think about if you're displaying images on some platform, that there's some responsibility by the platform. That's, you know, that's not going to be popular with Facebook, YouTube. And in fact, the heads of these companies have even, you know, come out like against Warren, for example, and said, hey, we're, you know, you want to regulate us. We don't want any regulation.
So, but they get around it a lot of times by saying, oh, all of our content is user generated, right?
Yeah.
So then it's therefore more difficult to regulate. But I mean, I definitely see user generated content heavily regulated in a country like China. So I think like what happens in the United States is some of the pushback is that we see it only in black and white terms, that if we regulate any of the content, then we risk censorship and we risk freedom of speech, right? Or we risk freedom of speech with censorship. And it's very scary to give corporations the control over what does and doesn't get censored, especially given that we're in such a hyper-partisan environment, right? So
what gets delivered up to you, right? I mean, what gets delivered up to you when you make a Google search? You know, frankly, my Google searches have gotten much worse over the past 3 to 4 years. I would say since about 2014, there's been a decline in my Google searches ability to bring me up stuff I want because of whatever bias they're putting into their algorithms and whatever it is that they're trying to manipulate in society. And, you know, I don't know what their goals are, but if it seems that they have some underlying interest in this process.
So with all the issues that social media has today, is social media still able to live up to its original promise about furthering democracy, democratizing the polity by allowing greater participation? Or is it now, are we now at a point where social media really needs to be seen as a tool or as a platform that undermines the trust in democratic institutions?
Well, the trust in democratic institutions was long gone before the internet. So I don't think we can attribute it. We can certainly, I think, helped. I think it certainly helps with polarization. And I'm not sure, even if we did try, right? I mean, I agree that the censorship issues are very real. And I'm a big free speecher and think that, you know, it's really important to hear stuff that you don't want to hear because then you recognize it as such and you go, yeah, that's not a good idea. Right. You need to be able to face arguments and learn to argue against them or for them. And the only way you can do that is by actually hearing them and recognizing them. But unfortunately, these aren't put in a context of discussion. I mean, having a whatever 30 character, you know, discussion with someone doesn't allow that level of interest. There's this You know, when you read a book, there's so much there. When you talk to someone, there's so much there. But when you have a media post, it's just a little bit. And you're not the complex book or complex process or individual, actually, right, that you are when I'm interacting you with in a dynamic way. And in fact, we know that that reinforces, you know, you feeling closer to someone or being pushed away by them because you're not seeing them as this complex person. You just get the little bit and it either pushes you away. You know, some friend likes something that you don't like. You know, that tells you something very specific about them in a context where it's not dynamic. And so, you know, you stereotype that, you exaggerate the meaning of that, and that creates an effective response back that can be very negative.
So going back to our original conversation about the speed of democracy and how social media helps to, for example, the Chinese government to address the needs and concerns of their citizens, do you think that democracy can actually keep pace with the changing speed of contemporary life?
Well, I hope so, because I certainly believe that democracy is right. But I think the important thing is you have to have the right institutions, right? And the institutions have to be there and they have to be willing to stand up. I mean, you know, I think that the founding fathers really thought of these things. And, you know, the idea that democracy is a slow process, I mean, that's why we have three branches. You know, maybe it's a good idea if we maintain and that the people agree that we maintain different power in different branches of government. So, you know, maybe divided government is even more important than ever, even though I can see how it's stifling and, it slows it down. But maybe that's actually one of the things it's supposed to do, right? It's disappointing to the side that's not getting what they want, but it goes back and forth who's not getting what they want. And that's the benefit of the design. So you need the right institutional design. You need those to be successful.
I think we're in a bit of a, it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out, right? Especially the polarization that's occurring on within our democratic country. And, you know, some of the task maybe for us is trying to figure out how to, you know, link people that disagree in conversation, right? And instilling this willingness to listen. So I know, you know, I get to teach, and when I teach, I do encourage my students to always look for things that they disagree with. And I myself try to do that as well. Always looking for things, different outlets that don't just tell me what I want to hear, because that's easy, right? I want to hear these other narratives, what else is going on.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's hard, you know, that's unusual. That, you know, if you're doing that, that's unusual. Most people can't take hearing the other side, especially when it's not a dynamic process. You know, they're not attracted to that. Most people isolate and silo themselves. So, you know, how we get to do that is difficult. And it's also difficult because we're very sorted. And I think that's important to think about. You know, we're just living around people who are very much like ourselves. And that's increased the polarization and the feedback loop a lot. I mean, just who we're going to run into is essentially just as maybe not just as, but somewhat problematic relative to social media as well. Yeah. Right.
Well, we are all out of time. So we want to thank you again, Dr. Atkinson, for joining us today. If you want to hear more from Lana, you can join us at the annual Frank Church Symposium on February 20th and 21st on the ISU campus in the Rendezvous ABC Suites. So the Frank Church Symposium is actually student-led, and they're welcoming distinguished scholars from around the country to discuss and engage in a public conversation on important international topics, something they do every year. And this year will be absolutely no different as they address the rise of authoritarianism, globalization, minorities and majorities, and media and a democracy. So thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you again in a couple months. This episode of Know Your Media was recorded at the KISU studios on the ISU campus. We would like to thank Jamin Anderson for his continued help with and support of the show. This and past audio recordings are available online at kisu.org/programs.